very short intro to Peter Paul, who's very kindly come down from London today to do this tour.
Oh, what?
I'm not a Londoner.
Oh, there you go.
Not anymore. No, just Oxford.
I was watching.
Slightly nearer.
So you were off Didcot,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah. Lovely.
I was confused by the train, so. From Oxford. And, just to say a few things about why Paul's speaking here. Obviously, this week we're looking at common land enclosure and that kind of aspect to it. We tried to put some more contemporary events on. Certainly last night when we were talking about Stokes Croft and Castle Park and some of the other sort of issues around gentrification and that. And we came across to tell the truth, what actually happened was is we noticed that the Festival of Ideas, or Ideals as we call it in Bristol, have got you speaking next week, is that right?
Nick me first.
So we thought we'd nick it first, because we thought, well, you should be speaking to a few of us, because we're involved in things, and perhaps not so many
people.
And
you don't charge £6, either.
No.
That's a fairly good reason to come.
I wouldn't like to comment on that, but no, we don't. And we had a look at what Paul's doing, and thought that it was highly relevant, considering it's talking about the changes that are occurring, and certainly in accelerated changes that are occurring now in cities and towns in Britain in terms of development, and changes in the way that consumption is occurring, I would argue. So we'd all get Paul down. Just to give you a bit of background about Paul, Paul's been writing about globalisation, anti-globalisation, for about 15 years. He's deputy editor of The Ecologist. And we've just discovered in the car back from the station that we kind of know people from Mexico. Paul was a campamentista, a peace observer out in the Zapatista autonomous zones of Chiapas in southeast Mexico in 2001, I believe. And I was actually out there at the same time, but we were in different places.
And
we know mates, so it's kind of quite a small world in some ways, I suppose. Just a couple of things I have to say every time to keep everybody happy here is running this space. First of all, if there's a fire, you go out through this fire escape, through the entrance you came in, across the street and into the car park. And if you want to go to the toilet, go down the stairs, take a left, and there's some blue doors with a sign on at the end. Okay? And that's it. I forgot to say that at the start. So I'm just going to hand you straight over to Paul.
Thanks. Okay. Talking about the old days, I also just bumped into some people who were at Salisbury Hill on the road protests about 15 years ago, which I was as well, so it's always quite interesting to be back, and I used to live in Canesham down the road for my sins, so which I was glad to escape from. But anyway,
there goes everything.
Yeah, my new book. I wrote a book about 5 or 6 years ago, about globalisation and resistance to globalisation around the world, and I went to places all over the world, from Mexico to South Africa to West Papua to the US, and I looked at communities that were resisting the globalisation juggernaut, why they were doing it, and what brought them together, if anything, whether it was a real movement. And it was interesting stuff. But obviously, I began to notice as I came back again, and I began to notice two things actually. I began to notice that everyone I talked to, from the Zapatistas to the ex-ANC supporters in South Africa who now turned against the ANC, to guerrilla fighters in New Guinea, to anti-consumer activists in America, we're all talking about the erosion of their sense of identity and the erosion of their sense of place by the process of globalisation. And of course, having come home and written the book, I noticed the same thing happening here in England, where I live and where everyone here lives as well. And it seemed to me that it was worth turning my eyes inward a little bit, or at least on the ground beneath my feet, and having a look at what that process meant, because as the name suggests, globalisation is something that doesn't just happen to other people, it happens here as well, particularly as we are arguably the country that invented it, better off for worse and possibly worse. So really the subject of the book I've just written, which is called Real England, is precisely that. It's looking at what the reality of the landscape is and the reality of place and perhaps its history, and how this is being erased by this process that we call globalisation, that you might want to call capitalism, whatever you want to call it, how the things that matter, the independence and the folk culture, are being removed by this process. And I thought I might start by talking about pubs, because if there's a symbol of England that probably people all around the world will recognise, it's the pub. There's nothing quite like the English pub anywhere else on earth, and there's nothing quite like English beer either, for better or for worse. For better, in my opinion, because there's nothing better than English beer. But I'm an environmentalist as well, and I have been for 15 years, and environmentalists tend to talk a lot about biodiversity, which is a word so sort of commonly used now that it's become quite meaningless. But this book isn't about biodiversity, but it might be perhaps about what we might call biodiversity. Because if biodiversity is an indicator of the environmental health of a nation, then biodiversity in England at least is an indication of its cultural health. So if we were living in a nation with a healthy biodiversity, we would be living in a nation in which every pub was different to every other one, in which it reflected the community that it was part of, rural or urban, working class, middle class, or a collection of all three, in which every pub sold different beer, had a different atmosphere, was a distinct independent place. And we would also be living in a country in which every town, every city, every region made its own beer in a way that the French do with their own cheese, and that reflected the environment, the water, the culture, the communities, again the sense of place, the names of the beers reflected the history of that particular place. That would be a nation with a healthy biodiversity, but we don't live in that nation. We live in a nation in which completely the opposite is happening, actually. We live in a nation in which 56 pubs are closing down every month. 56 pubs every month, that's four every day. Six urban locals closing every week. A country in which half of the villages in the country are now publics for the first time since the Norman Conquest. We had 6,000 breweries a century ago in this country, and we've got 600 now. And Courage in Bristol is one of the casualties. That was 300 years old when it closed. So with Morals of Oxford, where I live, which closed a few years ago as well and was converted into luxury flats, which will now cost me £300,000 for one of them, despite the fact they've only got two bedrooms. Only half of the remaining pubs, over half of the remaining pubs are in the hands of giant pub companies, which are owned by generally banks, have no interest in the beer or the culture or the pub itself, but they do have an interest in the property prices, which is why so many of them are being closed down and converted into upscale apartments. So in other words, beer diversity in the nation that we live in is in peril. Now, I don't want to talk too much about beer, interesting though it is. There is a chapter in the book on it, and it was the most interesting one to write, and certainly to research anyway. But the point is that this is a metaphor, this is a cultural metaphor of what's happening to England, and similar things are happening to what the reflections of cultures in other parts of the world. And what is happening here is the ongoing erosion of what you might call folk culture and our historical landscapes and the meaning that they have in them, and maybe what makes us who we are. Because the things that make places in England, landscapes, different, distinctive and special, are being eroded, and they're being replaced by things which would be familiar anywhere in the world. You get the same chains in every high street, you get the same bricks in every housing estate, the same menus in every pub, the same corporate logos in every street. The small and the independent and the meaningful and the local and all of the things that make history and folk culture live and come alive in a country are being erased, and they're being replaced by the corporate, the clean, the top-down, the progressive. And it's all done in the name of efficiency and growth and progress. But whatever words you use, you lose the complex relationship between people and places. And those things are dismantled from the top down, usually with nobody's permission. And the result of this is that all over England, as indeed increasingly all over the developed world, everywhere is becoming the same as everywhere else. Now, if you can look, if you like, at statistics, and I've got a few here and a few in the book. Some of them are quite suicide inducing. In the last decade, we've managed to lose 30,000 independent shops across the country. We are losing 50 specialist shops every week. We've got four times as many out-of-town shopping centres as we had 20 years ago. We've got a quarter of our bank branches have disappeared in 10 years, a quarter of post offices, half of our independent bookshops in 10 years, all over the country, just gone. 60,000 farm labourers have left the land. 40% of our dairy farms have disappeared in 10 years again. Farm income's fallen by 60%, destroying family farms all over the country, many of them hundreds, if not thousands of years old. In the wider countryside, you might have seen some of the damage that's happened over the last 50 years. We've lost 95% of our wildflower meadows, we've lost half of our chalk grasslands, we've lost 94% of our bogs, we've lost half of our lowland ancient woodlands, we've lost 200,000 miles of hedgerow. Take the apple. The apple is the English national fruit. It's probably as much of an indicator of national culture as beer is. We grow more varieties of apple than anyone else in the world. There are probably 15,000 varieties of apple in the world, and we grow 6,000 of them here, and they were developed here. We've lost half of our orchards again in 10 years. Again, this is a cultural loss. Property prices, meanwhile, all over the country, as we all know, are shooting up so insanely that most people can't afford to buy a house. In some parts of the country, notably Cornwall, which is the poorest part of Britain, property prices have gone up by 400% in 10 years. 400%. It prices local people out of the housing market, destroys entire communities at stroke, and with them goes the heritage and the culture of the region, and they're replaced by second homes. Our urban public spaces are festooned with more CCTV cameras than any other country in the world, and as we know, corporations dominate every area of national life, from retail to the National Health Service now. What this represents is the death of the small and the independent, and the rise of the corporate nation. So, what's going on? What's going on is globalisation. It's the same process that's going on everywhere else in the world. You set up nation against nation, and you force us all to compete in the global marketplace. And the values of the marketplace are the values of money. They're the values of GDP and the narrow measurements of economic growth. Now, this is not a new process, and the destruction of character and community that it creates is not a new process either. I'm sure we've all read Marx. Whether or not we have, and whether or not we agree with him, I still think that some of the things that Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto are the best description of the process of globalisation on cultures and on landscapes and on the way that the world is that anyone's ever written. The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionising the instruments of production and thereby the relations of production and within the whole relations of society, etc. All fixed, fast, frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned. And man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real condition of life and his relations with his kind. Now, apart from being extremely well written, it's true. Everything that is valuable, everything that has meaning, everything that is still and solid and that connects people to where they are, is swept away by this process. And this is something that is happening, as we say, all over England and all over the world. Globalisation needs a year zero every year. It needs to start afresh every year. It rejects culture, it rejects meaning, it rejects connection to place in Mexico, just as it does in England. And this is why, if we want to talk about the Zapatistas, for example, they frame their rebellion against both the Mexican state and the global economic process as a rebellion of the rooted against the rootless. People with an identity, indigenous and Mexican, and based on the land, against an economic process that has no identity and destroys everybody's in the name of profiteering and in the name of consumerism. Now, if you look at it in an English context, what I see happening here is the continuation of a process that began many centuries ago, the process of enclosure. This is, as we know, I'm sure, still with us. The landscape is parcelled up and sold off to the wealthy. And there are examples of this in every single chapter of my book. Working class street markets are replaced by branches of Waitrose. Farming families can't afford to stay in their ancestral villages because the second homes have driven up the cost of living. The countryside becomes the playground of gastro pubbers and 4x4 drivers. Tesco takes our money and it uses it to buy our government. And literally, a new enclosure is taking place in cities all around the country, including, apparently I'm told today, Bristol as well. Liverpool is one example I used in the book. Liverpool is just about to unveil, actually, a shopping centre called the Paradise Project in the centre of the town. It's fantastically named, isn't it? What they've done is they've taken 43 streets in the centre of Liverpool and they have effectively sold them to the Duke of Westminster, the country's sixth richest man. He's got them on loan for 250 years. Mm. And they are his. He runs a company called Grosvenor. And Grosvenor has demolished everything, including a public park in these streets, including a place called Quiggins, which is the centre of alternative culture in Liverpool, and it has abolished also, with the help of the City Council, all of the public rights of way in all of these streets. So you no longer have permission to walk down any of these roads unless Grosvenor's security guards allow you to. And Grosvenor's security guards will allow you to if you are shopping politely and nicely, and if you're not wearing a hoodie and you're not spitting, and certainly if you're not doing any political demonstrations. Now this is the biggest example of this kind of what's called a public realm agreement, which is effectively the City Council sells off your public streets to a private developer, and the private developer pays for the development, which is always a top-down corporate clone stores and executive flats, and in return they reap the profit and they look after the streets. The biggest example in Liverpool, but it's happening elsewhere, including apparently in Bristol, where there are now four privatised streets, I was just told. It's happening in London, it's happening in Birmingham, it's happening very quietly. Enclosure, when it was most famously going on under the Enclosure Acts of the 18th and 19th centuries, was a process of taking land in the countryside and parcelling it off to the wealthy, including the ancestors of the Duke of Westminster. But what was happening in the countryside is now happening in the cities as well. It's perhaps the final act of enclosure. And also, you're being filmed, so you better behave yourself. Now, there is some good news in the book, lest anyone thinks that it's incredibly depressing. And the good news is that all over the country there are people fighting this process. And everywhere I went, I spent 9 months going around the country meeting people who were fighting all of these things happening. And there are thousands of them out there. So there are shopkeepers in Norfolk battling Tesco's who are trying to take over their town. There are farmers in Devon fighting the attack on small farming and traditional farming, both from government and from corporate agribusiness. And in London and Macclesfield and Oxford, there are people who live on the canals, in canal boats, probably the last form of genuinely affordable housing, fighting off threats to the canal bank and the boatyards from yet more executive flats put there by British Waterways, a public company. There are people in ethnic minority areas in East London fighting the enclosure and the destruction of street markets for yet more executive flats. Things like this are happening all over the country. I think what people are beginning to realise is that what they're told are small local battles fought by NIMBYs against the inevitability of progress is actually something of a national movement beginning to coalesce. People fighting this enclosure process which is going on around England and elsewhere. The question is, and it's a question I raise in the book and I'm not sure I have an answer to yet, are there enough people who give a shit about it? Are there enough people fighting back? Are there enough people realising what's going on? Now, I've given quite a few talks around the country since the book came out, and I've met a lot of people who've all said, yes, this is happening where we live too. Yes, this is a campaign that's going on where we are. And people are quite excited about it. Not because it's a brilliant book, though of course it is, but because it's picking up on subjects which people feel really connected to. This stuff is happening everywhere. The privatisation, the destruction of community and place is happening everywhere, and yet nobody's really talking about it at a political level or in the media. People just present it as regeneration or progress, and nobody discusses these things at all. We're supposed to think about something more important like economic growth or the war on terror, but these things matter to people. They matter because they're rooted in people's communities. So the question is, do enough people care about these things? Are enough people going to fight back about them to make them a national issue that we can do something about? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that, as I said before, this is something that's been going on for 200 years. So I might finish by quoting a line of a section of poetry by John Clare, who is the famous poet of anti-enclosure, the man who was actually driven mad by the enclosure, literally driven mad by the enclosure of the lands that he knew, by people who had, in it, as he saw it and as I see it as well, no right to take them. This is a poem called Enclosure. O England, boasted land of liberty, with strangers still thou mayst thy title own, but thy poor slaves the alteration see. With many a loss to them the truth is known, like emigrating bird thy freedom's flown, while mongrel clowns low as their rooting plough disdain thy laws to put in force their own. And every village owns its tyrants now, and parish slaves must live as parish kings allow. John Clare was talking about the countryside, same things happening in the cities. The same things happening all over England. It's the last act of enclosure. And as it happens, what disappears is not just the literal, the technical aspects of who owns the landscape, but the meaning of that landscape and the communities that live on it. So if we want to see any liberty remaining in England, and if we want to avoid being parish slaves, then I think we need to stand up around the country against the new enclosures. And I think I can begin to see it happening. I hope it will happen fast enough to make a difference. But in order for that to happen, we all need to talk about it more, and we all need to spread the word. So I hope we can do that, because otherwise I do think that we remain slaves. So that's all I've got to say. And we can talk about it now, if you like. Questions or discussions or opinions or arguments would be welcome. So.
Amazing detail. You started off mentioning beer.
Uh-huh.
I used to buy a bottle of beer from Banks's Brewery. Their slogan was "Unspoiled by Progress."
I remember that. Yeah.
I thought, well, what a motto.
Do they still use it?
I'm not sure.
I'm interested in what you were saying about the private roads, because I'm a minibus one, and I collect pensioners and take them to supermarkets, and there's a street called Wade Street round the back. It's the fag end of the Cabot Circus car park.
Right.
And there's an old people's sheltered accommodation called Slim Court round the back. They've put a barrier up, and there's a guy in a part of the builders, and he's asking me why I'm going down here. I'm getting hopping mad at this. So I don't know if this is the start of something. They're blocking off a public right of way, and they're asking people what their business is in the street.
That's interesting. Yeah.
You know, is this one of the Bristol streets?
You need to find out from the city council what's going on. The city councils are very, very quiet about this process. They really don't like having people exposing it at all. I got an email yesterday from a photographer who has had an interesting experience in Middlesbrough. He was just in the town centre and he decided he was going to take a photo of something that he thought was interesting in the high street. And he was immediately surrounded by four private security guards from the local shopping mall. He said, "You can't take photos here." And they said, "This is a private street now, and we don't allow people to take photos. This is the main street, the main shopping street of the town." And he was physically attacked for having simply taken a photo of something entirely innocent on a public street, which now apparently is a private street. And this is happening all over the country. This is really something to be extremely worried about. And nobody will tell you it's happening. Nobody will tell you it's happening. I did a bit on You and Yours on Radio 4 a few weeks ago about this, and about the situation in Liverpool, and they sent a reporter up to Liverpool and they went around the shopping streets and they started asking people, "This is what's happening, all these streets have been privatised, does it bother you?" And the people said, "Well, I don't mind, it doesn't really bother me." They said, "The shops are quite good, they're better than they used to be and they're quite clean, so I don't mind." And I found that when I went to Liverpool as well, actually. There's hardly anyone. The main person I managed to find campaigning against this was from Manchester. Amazingly, people just didn't mind very much. Now, I don't know if that's a Liverpool thing particularly, or I don't know if it's just because people don't know about it, but I find that increasingly people don't even really care very much about this. Like, maybe it's also because this has been such an incremental process over the last 20 years of the removal of the idea of the public realm and public rights and the sort of the existence of anything non-private at all, that people now just doesn't even bother them. But I find it really worrying.
I think people do care. I think they don't know the implications of a lot of things. And I live on an outer estate in Bristol. It's like a 1950s council estate. And we haven't hardly got anything there, but what we have got is a lot of green space. And I think that is now, it's like a gold mine. You know, everybody wants to get in there. They want to get the land, build all over it. And I was sitting on neighbourhood renewal meetings, because I was organising a market which the council destroyed. Everyone, when I sort of complained about this, everyone was saying, "You're the only one who cares, you're the only one who cares." And I kept trying to get in the local newsletter, "Oh, nobody's interested in that. They want to know about, you know, Mrs. So and so down the road had kittens, because that cheers them up, you know." They don't want to know what's going on. And then eventually there was a meeting, we put flyers around ourselves, me and a couple of other people. 80 people come to that meeting, and 80 people have come ever since. In an area where we've been told, working class area, everybody's apathetic, they don't care.
Yeah.
People do care, and once they realise the implications of what's going on, they don't want it. So I think people do care, it's just they're not being told, and that's the biggest battle, is trying to get the information across.
Maybe it's also because you're giving them a way to act on it. Because that's another thing I find, that, you know, even when people do care, they think there's nothing they can do. And until somebody or some organisation stands up and says, "Well, here's what you can do," people just tend to feel powerless because everything's so massive. I think it's almost like what you might have with climate change or globalisation, or if you talk about these big nebulous issues, people think, "Nothing I can do about that."
You were first.
Two or three little points, really. First of all, the thing about taking photographs, one of our group was forcibly ejected from Cribbs Causeway, which is a big mall in sort of Bristol, for taking photographs in there.
Right.
He just took a couple of photographs and it was removed by the security guard. And they built galleries. My first experience, this is what, more than 15 years ago, in the galleries. I kind of went in there. At the time, I was reading a lot of cyberpunk stuff, so I was kind of into this sort of glass and everything. And actually, really interestingly, when I first went in the galleries the first week, there somebody was making. I think somebody was in there who was running the Muzak, was having a joke that there was Vangelis playing all the time, the music from Blade Runner. So I was walking around, this is kind of like a Blade Runner type environment now. But what happened was, I was with my girlfriend and we went out there. At the time, I kept taking Mondays off to go. We used to go out, a few Mondays off, and to go down and eat ice cream and that. So we went down there and they laid out all these, in the top part of the galleries, you know, they've got all those tables laid out, you know, where you can go and eat and everything. So we thought, "Oh, great." So we went downstairs, bought a couple of donuts and some ice cream, went upstairs, sat at the table. Within about 2 minutes, the security guards had arrived and said, "Oh, you can't sit here and eat that." I mean, I'd go, well, it's sort of like an open space, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, I would sit down and it's not part of any place, you know, it's not like I'm sitting outside of any cafe eating, my donuts, but they were like, no, you can't eat those here, and we were rejected from the galleries, like, for eating donuts at the table. And I was like walking up thinking, like, it is bloody bad. It is actually like bad. So I think it's been going on for a while, but.
Yeah. But I think the difference is that it's now moved from the private mouths out into the public streets, or what used to be the public streets, which have now become, they call them in America, they call them malls without walls. And it's been going on for 10 or 15 years then, the idea of effectively privatising the streets and farming them out. It seems to be coming here as well.
I think we could do with a bit of attacking the private car, and I was surprised that hardly featured in your book, as far as I could notice. For instance, this campaign for England or whatever, in King's North, she noticed the increase of cars in the last 10 years that she'd lived here. The fact that her car was kind of one of them didn't seem to really matter to her. Now, what I'd like to actually do is to draw attention to everybody to a Bristol victory. And that was about 120 years ago, a man bought an estate in, you don't know it, but some people might, it's called St. Anne's. And he locked up the gates of both ends of the estate. Now, this was not only a public right-of-way, it was a pilgrim's route. It was a route for people to go to work across the river and so on. And the trial took 100 years. Now, about 10 years ago, I made a leaflet about it, which I found nobody was in the slightest bit interested. So I thought, well, I'll make another try. So I've written a poem about it, and I read it to my poetry group, and they said it was too long. So anyway, this is the most exciting thing. Oh, that's right. So about 4 years ago, I got into this awful thing called local transport plans, which you might know.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, printed on the best quality paper and so on. So I said, look, we have just fantastic walking routes in Bristol. Why don't you introduce, you know, promote them? You're doing just roads. So the man's, and what we want is posts. Just like motorists, we'd like posts. And they said, no, you can have £3,000 for a leaflet. Well, so far we've had £12,000 for three lots of kind of bits of paper.
Right.
And this is our last, which has just come out. So if anybody's into walking, I mean, I think it's, you know, fantastic, because it goes through this St. Anne's Woods. And if we could ever get the pub people, because, I mean, this is the thing, we're all so disparate, aren't we? I'm pretty sure that the Pilgrim Inn still functions down in Brislington, and it would have functioned 120 years ago, I'm pretty sure. I know the Barley Mow's gone, anybody who's into pubs. And I think, so celebrating what our local open spaces, don't use the car. You know, show the children what there is on our doorstep. We have phenomenal walking routes in Bristol. The fact that the poor children probably will get killed crossing the road is sort of rather another matter, but, you know, I hopefully somebody here will show some interest afterwards.
That's very interesting. Actually,
No real
cycle park. Sometimes
it just ends
on. Oh, that's right! Yeah.
Same
it's quite hazardous to go around.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We have the same in Oxford actually, and in London. You're just going along and then stop, and then you nearly die. You either go under a lorry or into the pavement. That's great.
Yeah.
It's you're quite right. I didn't mention the car, which is possibly an omission, although I think there's a whole book to be written on that. It's been written many times for a reader. But I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It's one of these things that's very difficult. I mean, as an ex-road protester, I kind of know that. Trying to get people out of their cars is very hard. I mean, I remember all the opinion polls that used to go on when we were doing the road protests, and you'd ask the public what they thought, and they'd say, too many cars on the road, definitely people need to drive less. But I'm not going to, because I need my car, but all these other people, they're doing unnecessary journeys. It's always the same. It's like the opinion polls you get now about supermarkets or something. You always get a majority of people saying, yep, supermarkets, they're very bad, we all need to go to local shops. But they don't. They go to the supermarkets because they think somehow someone else is going to do that. I was talking to a bookshop owner in Oxford the other week. The owner of an independent bookshop just closed down. And he said, look, you should get all these people from the local area coming in and saying, oh, so nice to have this bookshop here. I really like having a local bookshop. And then they just walk out. They wouldn't buy anything. They go and buy it from Amazon. But they like the idea that there is a local bookshop there. And, you know, partly that's a price thing, isn't it? They're always twice as expensive. But it's so hard to get people out of their cars. The only way to do it is to use the stick. But governments won't use the stick because they're the voters. So, I mean, at least it's not as bad as America, where the price of gasoline is an electoral issue. then you have to pledge to halve it, otherwise you stand no chance of becoming president. But,
but it's, and it's not so bad, you can actually get out of your car and walk in Britain, which you can't do in a lot of America.
I've been to Los Angeles, it's unbelievable. There are no pavements in the river. There literally aren't any pavements. I mean, you can't walk from one side of the road to the other. I had a friend who went to Los Angeles and he was staying in some motel, and he wanted to go to the shop, which is on the other side of the road, and they said, oh yeah, you need to get a cab and go around there. He said, no, I'm just going to walk across the road, and they kind of looked at him. And he walked, just walked across up the road and across it, and people were looking at him like he was mad. Nobody walks anywhere, but anyway. So it could be worse, I suppose. But yes.
If you're in America, I just wondered if you knew, I mean, how far ahead of the curve are they across the Atlantic? I mean, and what kind of resistance has it been to privatisation
in America
over there? Yeah.
Very little, actually. It's interesting, actually. I mean, in my last book, I went to America to look at what people were doing about these things. And one of the good things about the US in particular is that in terms of local government, they're much better off than we are here. They've got much stronger systems of local government. So there are people in communities all over America who, they have something called a ballot initiative in a lot of communities in America, which means that if enough people want it, you can put a new law up for voting on by the community. So if you get a petition of, say, 500 people, then there has to be a local referendum on whether you should have a new law or something. And this happens all over the place. And there are people who've used this to put laws in place that limit the number of chain stores in a town centre, for example, or ban corporate farming, or ban GMOs in particular counties. So in that sense, it's actually very good. And one of the things I'm talking about in my book is that we need a real, proper, decent strengthening of community democracy here, so that we can have things like that, so that communities can start to decide these things for themselves. But obviously on another level, they're far, far more corporate than we are, far more controlled by corporate interests than we are. And if you talk to activists in America, lots of them are just suicidally depressed about it, because it just seems to get worse. The president in particular just has to govern for corporations, because he's owned and bought by corporations all of the time. Not quite that bad here yet, but you know, they always say that we're sort of about 15 years behind America, so it's probably going in that direction. But all of our politicians from all of our political parties take all of their ideas from America, not the good ones like ballot initiatives, but all of the ones about wars on Iraq and the free market being the solution to every social ill. So and that, you know, people presumably thought that was going to change when we got a Labour government, but obviously it just got worse. So since we're going to get a Tory government soon, I don't see it getting much better. So I don't actually know what to do about that. And one of the things I think needs to happen is that people just need to start taking the initiative at local level without waiting for anyone to give them permission. I mean, there's no reason, for example, why we can't hold ballot initiatives here.
No.
Just hold them. I mean, people started to do this. I can't remember what community it was, but a few years ago, there was a community that decided to hold a referendum on the euro or on the European Constitution, and they decided that they were going to have a vote on whether Britain should be a member part of the EU locally. Now, whatever you think of the issue, it was really interesting because it got people talking about it, and it had absolutely no legal, you know, part at all, but it made people think. If people start holding their own ballots in communities and having conversations about whether we should, you know, limit the number of chain stores in a town or do whatever we want to do or ban the privatisation of public space, then it might not have any legal power, but it has a big moral power, and it gets media attention and it makes politicians listen. If enough people start doing that without asking for permission, then you kind of get local democracy by default. If enough people do it, you can't be ignored. So it's kind of what they're going to do in Scotland about the Scottish referendum on independence, actually. The Scottish Parliament wants to put forward a referendum on independence. They've got no power to do that. And if they have one, it's not legally binding. But if they have one and lots of people vote for independence, it's not something the government can ignore. It's the same principle, I think. So I think probably the best way to do things on all these issues is just to start getting active locally. And not waiting for anyone to give us permission. I think the English just kind of like people giving permissions to do things all the time. We're a very obedient nation. It's part of the problem. You don't have this problem with the French. They just start burning things the minute they're not happy. But but we just say, righty ho, that's the law.
You might be seeing the Scotland.
Well, no. I think the solution is to re-radicalise England. You know, we've got a radical tradition here as well, and we need to revive it instead of being so bloody obedient all the time.
Yeah.
Just me.
Not just you.
No.
No, well, all right, not just me.
Yeah, I've just got a few sort of random thoughts. I mean, sort of, it's interesting the quote from Marx. I'm a Marxist, and it's in no way like a, you know, Marxist analysis that I've got about these issues. But it's just sort of random things. I mean, I'm sort of like really involved in community stuff in Eastern, which is quite, you know, very, you know, in terms of Bristol, quite a vibrant.
density area, you know, where the community is through certain sort of mechanisms, sort of, you know, kind of responding to the sort of need to kind of involve people, you know, people in decisions about their own community. And although I can, you know, totally agree with you that the sort of sway of sort of like decisions that are made, you know, sort of that relate to, relate up our communities to sort of like the kind of global situation, you know, under capitalism, you know, is going against us. But, you know, I think there's some quite interesting sort of, you know, examples where it's perhaps going the other way, although, you know, kind of like quite you know, small steps, etc. But I just wonder, sort of like a few things, ideas, I just throw some random ideas at you, really. A couple of things that I've been involved in. One's like an environment task group, which is, you know, kind of like, you know, tries to do a variety of things, you know, kind of organise little bits of green spaces, try to look at like green spaces, what the current maintenance contracts are for them, you know, in terms of the council's responsibility, etc. Because I think a lot of people's attitude is that, you know, that there is a kind of like local council, you know, like for its faults, it is, there's a certain kind of democracy there, but you know, we should at least try to make work at the level, you know, kind of the sort of kind of basic level, and then kind of, you know, on top of that, try to get either the community try to campaign for a rise in that kind of maintenance level, basic kind of level, but at the same time involve communities and actually doing concrete things, and you know, actually involving them in doing, you know, kind of acting and in a way, you know, taking control of their environment to an extent. The other thing that I'm involved in from time to time is that there's something called the Planning Task Group. This is all under the auspices of an organisation called Eastern Community Partnership, which is a kind of sort of started off by the council, but it's got its own sort of independence. But I mean, unfortunately, Bristol City Council lost a lot of its regeneration money, so all the attempts that we, you know, all the sort of steps we've made to kind of develop that partnership is kind of like, you know, sort of the rug's been taken onto our feet to a certain extent. But the planning task group is interesting because it looks at some of the, not the sort of like the more individual kind of planning applications for, you know, kind of houses being converted into flats, that type of thing. There's so many of those decisions being made that it's not very easy to kind of overview those things. But, you know, it looks at kind of like wider applications, you know, like you were talking about public houses. You know, if like a sort of developer comes in and wants to take over a public house and, you know, sort of like it hasn't been doing so well. One question I've got about that is that one of the decisions that's often presented is that, you know, kind of like a pub hasn't been doing very well for quite a long time. And, you know, even though there are people like involved in that group or, you know, lots of people in the community that wouldn't want to see that particular pub sort of close down and become, you know, no longer a community kind of resource. You know, what do you do where you know, a sort of a community develops in such a way that, you know, there is a certain, not inevitability, but, you know, kind of like that particular, you know, pub hasn't been doing well, and, you know, kind of like, you know, the private sort of the rules about private ownership mean that, you know, that at the end of the day they're going to, you know, sort of like, if they think it's in unviable, they're going to kind of sell on to, you know, sort of developers. And I think one of the things that we try and do on that group is to sort of kind of like follow some sort of, you know, kind of common sense things about, you know, who the developer is, what they're trying to do, making sure that, you know, kind of, I don't know, there's proper waste management for that development, and, you know, and generally speaking, trying to oppose, you know, like for example in Eastern, sort of like lots of like one and two bedroom kind of unaffordable kind of flats. I mean, but in a way, I don't think people would probably be moved to Eastern unless it was like reasonably affordable anyway. One of my questions is on a local level. I mean, I'm a Marxist, I'm opposed to kind of private ownership and all the sort of laws that go around that. But when you're involved in things because you think, well, there's an opportunity to kind of like do those precisely those things that you're talking about, get more democracy for the community. What do you do when you're kind of presented with a sort of like a development like that and how to make decisions around it? And just the other thing was that I kind of get a bit frustrated with, I mean, it kind of sort of like kind of, there's lots of sort of hippies, I suppose, in Eastern, and much as I love them, I sort of get a bit frustrated with that, oh, let's all go to this sort of social, and it's about the community, and there's this thing called Transition Eastern, which is sort of talking about how we're going to move to this kind of, like, you know, non-petrol based economy. But people actually aren't, I mean, I'm a, what's called a street monitor for my road, so I report stuff for my road, and I always say I'm a very involved street monitor because I actually knock on people's doors, you know, and talk to them about a kind of range of things like clearing out the alleyway, the back of the top behind the houses and stuff. And I get really frustrated that people don't seem to want to put their money where their mouth is. They don't seem to want to do something radical, like kind of just talking to somebody on the street about litter or, you know, is that how they're getting on with their recycling, you know, situation. And I kind of feel like, you know, you're talking about, like, the connection to the past. I mean, it's quite a random thing, but I really like folk dancing, folk music. I mean, it's almost like we've lost, unless we kind of develop our own folk history that's really meaningful in our own communities, we've lost that connection that we've had, like, you know, to, you know, kind of more traditional sort of form of living, because we've lost some of those cultural things. But, you know, I think we've got to develop them again and actually do the work in the community to bring them back,
yeah.
or develop new things. You know, so I
kind of
just get a bit frustrated that people, it's all talk and no action.
Easily done. True, yes. Well, I think two questions, I think. I think they answer the first one about what you do if you're working on a local authority, for example, and you get a pub coming up for closure. I mean, the answer to that really is that local authorities don't have enough power to tackle those questions. So, for example, if there's an application for a new cafe on the high street that goes to a local authority, the local authority has no power to say, well, we'd like to have an independent cafe rather than fourth Starbucks on the street. You can only make a decision about whether you want to have a cafe there, and you don't have any power to do anything else, and that's partly because of World Trade Organization remit.
But that's not actually strictly true. The planning officers can reject planning applications, and they often do, and then they, you know, put certain conditions on why those applications should go through.
They can't, but they're not allowed legally under the WTO rules, under European rules, to do what they call territorial discrimination. In other words, they can't say, we don't want this because it's another Starbucks, but we will have an independent version. They might do that, possibly by other means, craftily, but they're not allowed to do it for that reason. They're not allowed to say, we want to promote independent businesses on the high street now. In terms of pubs, and it's very interesting that pubs are in some places declining because not enough people don't want to want to go to the pub. I mean, I personally advocate direct action on pubs, actually, because it involves going to the pub and drinking lots of beer.
Yeah.
That's direct action. If you want to support the pub, get down there and don't drink Stella, right? Drink proper beer. But you know, that's direct action. Some of the landlords I spoke to in the book have got plenty of cases of pub companies deliberately running down pubs so they can get permission, putting in crappy landlords who don't know what they're doing or squeezing them so dry that they can't make a profit. This happens all the time because they know they're going to make more money selling them off their houses. Again, that's very difficult to prove, but it does happen. And I think local authorities need more power to tackle that kind of thing, which they don't have. And the second issue is quite interesting, actually. I think probably all of us are guilty of, you know, if you're an activist, you tend to sort of want to hang around with other activists, don't you? There's something called, somebody once called activistism, which is where you think you're sort of a community activist, but you're actually just hanging around with a bunch of people who think they're community activists and not necessarily talking to other people in the community who might be different to you and doing the boring stuff about bin emptying and things. Which, you know, and I'm probably guilty of that myself to some extent. I mean, everyone wants to hang around with people who are similar to them. That's kind of a human trait. But in order to actually do something with the community, you do have to reach out in a way that and do lots of unglamorous stuff rather than sitting around talking about revolution, which is always more fun, especially if it's in a pub. But so, yeah, I think that you do need to reconnect with communities. But again, it really just comes down to people making a choice that they want to do that. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it comes down to people thinking that if they do that, it's going to make a difference. Because, I think, you know, we get a load of stuff about how people in this country are so apathetic. I don't think people are apathetic, actually, but I do think that they think there's no point in voting and often no point in getting involved much at community level because nothing makes any difference. Because people don't think they've got the power, they don't think there's any real political choice anymore, they don't think the local government has enough power, which it doesn't because it's been stripped of it over the last 20 years by both parties. And I think people just don't bother. Actually, and one of the reasons they don't bother is because it doesn't make any difference when they do. And time again, all over the world, as I saw in my last book, if you actually give people power at local level, or if they take it, then they start using it. Because people actually do want to make a difference for things and change things for the better. But we're just a nation of apathetic consumers, which is the way they want us, really. That's the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to sit at home and watch the telly and go to Tesco's and buy stuff. And that contributes to economic growth and makes us all better. And we don't, you know, getting involved in things politically, locally, is a threat to that. So, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory, but that seems to be the way things work. I think that, I don't know which way around it is. It's a chicken and egg thing, you know. Do you give people power and then they start acting on things, or will people not act on things until they've got some power, or I don't know, but...
I think people need information before they can empower themselves, and I think that's what's lacking in the planning process. People don't understand the process, and it's such a boring process that most people don't want to engage with it.
No, it's true.
But if people start reading planning notices on lampposts and in newspapers, for example, when they're making private streets, when they take away public rights of way, that actually has to go through Parliament. That can't be done through the local council. And they do have to publish in the national and local papers that they're doing it. So there are little clues to be picked up. I don't think most people pick up on
things. You have to know where to look, don't you? You have to be able to look in the right trade papers before you find out what's going on, basically.
Or read Hansard every day, which is bore you to sleep every day.
Well, there's no real network of local democracy in this country. It hasn't been for a long time. People don't expect it. Again, it's like private security. People just kind of expect it. There's no expectation that people are part of this public realm, and we've all got a right to civic engagement, and we should all be doing it. Like there is in some other countries in Europe. France is a good example of that. People are always doing stuff at local level, and they're very involved at the community level as well, and they're very bolshy about their rights and what they're going to, you know, they're going to take part, and we've got locally elected mayors in all the villages and all this kind of stuff, and it makes a difference because people think that they're running things, at least to an extent, but you never get that here. I don't know whether you did before my time, but you certainly don't now.
Well, I think there's tremendous opportunity there, that people don't care is the generalisation, but maybe that's because there's a comfort zone thing, as well as what you said about choice and people being able to make different choices so they're apathetic. But I think there's a tremendous opportunity in the reduction of civil liberties that are happening as a result of corporate-owned government and so on and so forth, globalisation as a whole, that people will start to care once, you know, the toys are taken out of their pram a few more times, you know, and that there's a tremendous opportunity for civil disobedience once people find that their resources are dwindling and their freedom is dwindling. I don't think, because we're quite, well, we're very privileged, and because it takes quite a lot to actually realise that your freedom is withheld, and most people wouldn't care because nobody's telling them to stop doing what they consider normal activity, say in a privatised shopping street. If you're just going about your daily business and that's what you do, you're within the sort of normal acceptable range of human behaviour, then of course you're not going to be bothered whether it's privatised or not. And Boris Johnson's just said people can't drink on public transport in London, whether you think that's a good thing or not. That's an example of something that will piss a lot of people off, and it's that sort of thing that motivates people. But because we've got all our comforts provided for us currently, it's difficult to motivate people. But I think that whole sort of information provision side is something that's very important, and there's a tremendous potential there that needs untapping. Those of us that feel inspired to take some action, there is that kind of just pushing the edges of it that could happen. And I mean, it can go one way or the other, in the way that the fuel strikes have happened and people start rioting because, you know, they can't get enough petrol instead of seeing the bigger picture. So it's sort of recognising the niches and the opportunities and seizing them to educate and to inform and to address the core issues behind things, because it's a joined up thinking. Like you say, people don't talk about it in that way on television or in the media. It's represented as progress and regeneration and something we should be applauding, and the joined up thinking, I think, is the opportunity that's missed time and time again. I work a lot in the estates around Bristol, and there's something about pubs that I'd like to share as an example of this, which is in Knowle West yesterday. I realised while talking to my colleague that there's hardly any pubs with any kind of name there at all. It's all social centres. And social centres are an amazing thing, and I know that it's something that's sprung up within activist culture in Britain as well, and this actual building is an example of that as well. and what's going on here right now, but you know, they're pretty grim places. You don't want to hang out there. But what's really interesting, because I work a lot with children playing outdoors and reclaiming green space for children to play, which is quite a hard thing to do, especially in places like Knowle West. And there's these kind of razor wired spiked CCTV social centres that carry in tarmac, and then they've got these kind of playgrounds and football courts and places to sit where children can play in the most unwelcoming place. But it's really interesting that that provision is there, because in a lot of chain clubs that's diminished as well, the rights to sort of spread out and to express and to have a family life in that kind of surroundings. And it's amazing that these social centres, they're a great example of a community owned space, really. Mm-hmm. They were built by the community. I work right next to one as part of one in Hartcliffe. And so quite often we share our outdoor office and centre space with funerals, weddings, all kinds of situations going on in the community, and lots of beer and fags. And it is really interesting that after there's not a chain pub within miles of the diameter of that area, really, and that's something to be celebrated, I think. I do really think that it's to do with motivating people to care, and of course they're not going to care if nothing that they personally do. Clearly, it's like first they came for the Nazis, isn't it? I've known that these streets are privatised since I started demonstrating them against GM and stuff outside the Tesco's Express just down the road. And I think a lot of city centres are owned by insurance companies, aren't they? I don't know if many people know about that. And this is pre-Terrorism Act and pre-lots of criminal justice stuff. You can't protest in it because it's owned privately. I think it's a bigger phenomenon. The street just outside here is very much privatised.
But interesting, the privatisation of the streets is almost like it's like a step backwards. I mean, sometimes we talk about it as if it's a new thing, but you know, pre-Victorian, it's Victorian as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all the roads were toll roads and the canals were all privately owned and all the rest of it. But
like this lady just missed that, where I was talking about the pubs in Knowle West. Are you from Hartcliffe or
Ray?
From Loch Leeds. Yeah. Okay. When you spoke about community, lots of green space around, I thought you were a pub. Loch Leeds, it's another one. Yeah, so we were talking about space.
Yeah, I just wanted to say back and say community involvement. I think there's a contradiction there, quite interesting. But we did about 4 years ago when this happened, field was a bite of a certain public space that had been taken over by an academy school. And we're going to be in that, it was a bit last night. But one part of what we did was, because we're all footballers, you know, playing the local leagues and that, so we decided to make a kind of an investigation of public playing fields, you know, because we knew that lots of them had disappeared. We were particularly targeting those places that weren't parks. So we kind of had a little hierarchy of spaces that were under threat, and kind of the safest ones, in inverted commas, were parks. And then you go down to like kind of playing fields, and then you go down to factory recreation grounds, and then the bottom one is completely unprotected space. So basically most of those were pretty unprotected. What I mean by that is that you could develop them. So we went around Bristol, and there was obviously, South Bristol has been, I mean, I don't know if you know the sites, but you know, you've got Hengrove Park, you've got the DRG place, you've got Imperial, you know, you go around these places, and most of them have been partly or wholly developed now, and certainly Imperial half of it's gone. But what was interesting was just wondering about, you know, as we were filming it, you know, I remember down on, there's another one, I've got the name of it now, near DRG, you know, in St John's Lane. It's DRG, I used to play for once, got, you know, the housing estate now. And then round the corner was another park, and we met some people there, and we were just wondering about, so what are you doing? So we said, well, we're making this film about playing fields because this is being kind of, you know, kind of privatised. And they said, oh yeah, you know, yeah, they were local. And they just said, like, yeah, you know, we thought, you know, we did the right thing. We got a petition together. We went through it. All hundreds of people signed it. We went in the council. They ignored us. And that was the end of it. And we got this story fairly consistently in these places when we talked to people and wondered about, so what's happening about this, you know. But the most interesting thing to me was is that people had followed the democratic process through, you know, and I've never, since I've been involved in Packers Field and these playing field stuff, I've never heard so much vitriol and kind of and sadness in some ways against the council. I mean, you just hear it all the time. The people are not only, you know, feel totally separated from the political process, no question. And there are reasons for that, we won't go into that. But secondly, more importantly, was that they were very angry as well. And so when we talk about apathy, we have to be a little bit careful. Apathy, to me, means part of the world not being interested. What I was getting from a lot of people just walking into the playing field was not that. What I was getting from was anger, and in some cases, hatred of the council. And so I don't know whether it's right to say apathy. I think what happens is people just feel so separated from the process that they're angry about it as well. So what that means to me is, as well, because I believe, you know, I don't know if you got those pictures last night, but this is a demonstration that came up 3 weeks ago against the developments in Stokes Croft, gentrification of Stokes Croft, just down the road. And that demonstration came out of an organisation that basically was about 10 days in 500 people turned up. Most of the people there were actually clubbers who'd come to protect their clubs. But that demonstration and the cycle path one and the other ones, because there is a separation between the democratic process and people, if you actually do something, it has a much bigger impact now. That's my belief. I actually believe we can get on the streets now. Because of the kind of feeling that, you know, for the council definitely react. Because there is such little participation, such little popular democracy, that when you actually do something, it has an impact. And I was expecting about 10 years' time, when hopefully the streets are full every bloody weekend with something going on, that it may not have as much impact then. I mean, so then you're talking about changing the democratic process, and I think that we're talking about popular democracy is really important. But I do think at the moment there is an opportunity that it will have an impact down the streets, because there is so little, in the last year, so little going on. I mean, that. And last thing I'll shut up, but this thing about relations of force is really interesting. I mean, personally, I kind of believe that the way democracy works is quite interesting, because if you, you know, for example, that cycle path demonstration, there's about 1,500 people on it or something. They tried to, I don't know whether Paul knows, but they tried to put a bus route on the cycle path. We might talk about some of the cycle path of Bristol's bar.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It was built on the old railway track in the 1980s. Early 1980s, and they tried to decide if they wanted to put.
I was reading about that actually. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing to me is you put 1,500 people on the streets, right? And which you can argue is pretty undemocratic. Mm. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not 20,000. It's no. Not, you know, it's a major deal. 1,500 people go on the street one Saturday afternoon in the sunshine, and they backed off. Now, it's not over yet, but they backed off. So it's trying to get through to people in their minds that democracy doesn't work the way that we are told it does. Mm. It does work through relations of force, in a sense. Like, it doesn't work through, like, do you know what I mean? To me, that's, yeah. They've made that decision, or they're going to make that decision. Why should 1,500 people make a difference? Mm. But it does make a difference. And I think it's trying to get across to people that if you do something, you know, your relations of force here, and that they're not really to do with who's elected. Mm. You know, it's really to do with how much they think they can get away with. And if they see opposition, they tend to withdraw. Certainly, on Packers Field, as an example, they, yeah, the meetings we went to, they turned up with 10, we turned up with 80. Mm. And, you know, we were articulate, we argued, or we made that up, and there was a deal. So I think there's something going on.
Yeah, I agree with that. That happens all over the place, and it's always been the case. I don't think people are apathetic. That was the point I was making. They're not apathetic. Mm. They're engaged, but they don't think there's anything they can do about it. Because legally there isn't much. But all they have to go through a long, drawn-out planning process. But I agree, you know, you take to the streets, you get a proper, organised campaign going, and it usually makes a difference. Actually, I think something else somebody said to me at a talk recently was quite interesting. They said, these guys aren't as powerful as you think they are. And I know that's true of corporations. I mean, I've been doing a bit of work with Greenpeace. The minute Greenpeace sits on somebody's roof, they immediately back down. It's astonishing. I mean, some of the biggest companies in the world, Unilever, just backed down. They've been using palm oil from Borneo to fill their margarine with. And the minute Greenpeace just did a report on it and threatened to turn up on the doorstep, they announced a moratorium. And that, you know, that's a big example, because Greenpeace.
The G8
as well, it's the same thing. It's the G8. I mean, Greenpeace is a fairly big organisation, but the same thing happens at local level. I mean, loads of successes go on all the time because people just get out and do it. And I think that people are just persuaded that that doesn't make a difference, or that there's no point. But often there is a point. Because like you say, the authorities don't usually expect opposition. If they don't get any, they reasonably assume that nobody cares. But actually, that's often people who do care just thinking, well, what can I do? But, yeah.
I think we've got to be very careful with getting involved in these partnerships with the council. Because they, you know, you just see them use people up. They keep getting you to go to more and more and more meetings, and you seem to have no say at all. Really, at the end of the day, they listen to you and then just do what they want. But I think the best role to have in those meetings is to go there to get information, and then to go around telling people. And when we started having our meetings of 80 people, they have started to sit up a bit. I still think at the moment they seem to be doing all of it all through. But they're very clever in the way that they do everything. You know, they wanted to build on the allotments, and about 10 years ago they fenced off either end, so nobody even knows there's allotments there now. And then they say, oh, nobody's using the allotments, so we're going to build them. Even though they're underneath electric pylons, so everyone's going to get cancer at least, they want to build cancer hazard. So we did a big campaign to stop it, and we thought we succeeded. They actually voted against it in council. And then a couple of weeks later, we get a letter through, please come to a consultation about the kind of development you want on the allotment. We have to go there, how many houses do you want? How tall do you want the houses? Not do you want the houses at all.
Yeah.
You know, they're just so sneaky. It's really
that's another legal issue, isn't it? I mean, this happens all the time. Most of the planning decisions are made by regional development authorities in England now, which no one has ever heard of. Completely undemocratic organisations that are stitched up by the Blair government. Stuff from corporate placement and the friends of the politicians. Nobody knows who they are. Nobody gets to vote for them. They make the decisions on planning. And they then say to the councils, here's where you're going to build, or here's what you have to build. And usually these consultations that you get at local level are exactly like that. Like, what kind of development would you like? And they're legally not allowed to discuss whether you would like to have a development at all. But you are allowed to talk about, you know, the colour of the gates, that kind of thing. This happens everywhere. It's astonishing. And nobody, again, nobody complains.
I had it framed recently by Norwest Health Park, which we're trying to protect from housing development at the moment. It's the only health park in the country. The next is going to be in Cambridge. And they said, how much of your green space are you willing to give up in order to keep some? It's so many. I was like, that is the consultation.
Never heard it framed like that before.
That's what they said to us.
Yeah,
they had to fill up our green space to provide us with facilities.
Oh.
And we said, well, you've taken away all our facilities.
Yeah.
You've taken away the youth centre, you've taken away the schools, you've taken everything away. Mm-hmm. Now you're promising us we're going to get them back. Give them back to us first, you know, and then we'll think about it. But they weren't. They said it has to be funding. It's like they're sort of explaining everything, but there's one little pot of money, and that's the only bit of money it can only use. Like Loch Lees is an island, you know, we've got to fund ourselves. Meanwhile, they're taking all the money from our taxes and they have to fund nice parks and all that in Clifton.
Mm.
You know, it's just.
Well, that's another thing that local authorities don't have, and that's a way of taxing the local population or changing the taxes. I mean, another, you know, good idea is participatory budgeting, which happens all over the place now. It started off in Brazil, but it's happening all over Europe, which is when, you know, groups of people from the community actually sit down and decide how their money's going to be spent locally.
Mm.
And it's fantastic when that happens, because the council says, well, this is the amount of money we've got to spend this year, and you have meetings all across the community which anyone can come to and vote on about how they actually want that money to be spent. And then the population gets involved in those decisions. How much do you want to spend on green space? You know, how much do you want to spend on cycle lanes? How much do you want to spend on recycling? All these kind of things. And then you get a decision that actually, to a large extent anyway, it reflects what people actually want, or at least the people who can be bothered to come to the meetings want. And again, it's something that doesn't happen here. And it's something that... The reason that a lot of these privatisations of city streets are happening is that the council is strapped for cash. And they know that if they flog off their streets to Grosvenor, then in Liverpool, Grosvenor's spending £1 billion redeveloping the city centre, which is money the council would never have. And the area was very run down, so they'd say, well, flog it off to you and you'll put chain stores and executive flats on. And apparently, no one will really mind about it. So it's a very attractive option for councils, because they haven't got any money. And also, they then don't have to look after the streets, because Grosvenor does the litter collection, it does the policing, it does everything. Mm. So it's effectively a corporate domain. And if no one's out on the streets complaining about it, then they're going to keep doing it, because it's an easy option for them.
There's a limit. One solve everything.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out.
Can I just come back on what you're saying, or a lot of people have said, and I definitely don't want to give the impression that I'm sort of saying like local councils like this sort of, you know, don't democratic sort of beacon in any way, but I suppose what I am saying, and I think that's really interesting what you said about you know these getting involved in these partnership type bodies, you know, you can end up being kind of used as a kind of bit of smokescreen, really, a sort of token gesture, you know, for the community to be involved, and then when it comes to big decisions, you know, kind of bypassed. But I suppose what I'm saying is that that where there's opportunities to kind of like you say, gain more information and perhaps, you know, sort of make decisions that can have some influence, and
you know, and affect, like, you know, planning decisions. I mean, I think there have been some examples in Eastern where, you know, planning applications have been rejected, and, you know, much better ones, you know, eventually sort of gained, like chocolate factory sort of development. I mean, yeah, ultimately, I suppose, you know, the kind of the way that decisions are made is determined by the society that we live in, you know, and it being a capitalist society. So it's difficult, really, because I'm not sort of saying hailing those as, you know, kind of great achievements either, but I think the main thing that I was also trying to say, really, was that you know, we kind of have to be engaged with people on, like, you know, come back on the kind of, like, really nitty-gritty stuff, and, you know, to kind of go wider than you know, the people that normally have those kind of, ideas about their community, really, kind of a conscience about their community, and, you know, to sort of make people kind of feel that you know, that they can care about their area, and, you know, if they feel that they can't affect, like, their own street and their own community and affect its development, then I think people do get really disconnected. So I suppose what I'm sort of kind of arguing for is to kind of go beyond, you know, to kind of connect with people that don't normally engage in any kind of process, really. So.
I would also have more involvement with the local authority recently to actually get this job, which was an interesting thing. First time in my life, having a job. And realising being part of the community in the voluntary sector and in dialogue with what I see as quite a progressive arm of the council, which is youth and play, they seem very progressive and have held up nationally as a good beacon of good practice and all the rest of it. And I've always been, you know, suspicious of councils and government of any kind because of the various corruptions and power struggles within. It sort of seems inevitable. But I've actually found through this process of engaging with the mainstream, engaging with the mainstream forms of dialogue and so-called democracy, that I felt quite heartened. Number one, the councils have now got some dictate from above that they do have to engage with what's called the third sector, community and voluntary sector now. They have some dictate to make that engagement happen. And you know, it's not a humanless beast, the council. It's made out of humans, and some of them are radical. Some of the people I've met that work for the local authority, and I'm one of them now, which is really strange. It's, you know, they're humans, and there's a lot of people working from the inside, maybe not very effectively, or maybe not working in a way that represents their own beliefs themselves, but there are those people there. And what I've come to realise is that what they want from community sector is strategies, joined up thinking, is one voice from a partnership of different groups. And when you say don't get drawn into that partnership process, I think there's a distinction to be made between a partnership with a local authority and a partnership SNP, that's more like a parsnip, isn't it? A partnership across the community, where you join with other community groups. And there's political issues involved in that. For instance, some of the ripple effects that have happened from the transition movement, where people feel defensive, well, hang on, I've been in this Friends of the Earth group or Climate Action Group or Radical Action Group for years now, and now transition have hijacked that agenda and are calling it their own, and they haven't been doing the work, blah, blah, blah. It's one of the things I heard recently. And I thought, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because surely they want the same thing. We all want similar things there, so we should be working in partnership. And I think if we, instead of blaming the council in lots of different ways, if we find different ways that they, you know, address it in a way that they want to hear, in a way that's more powerful, which is a unified voice, I think that helps achieve greater things. It also makes it easier for them to actually think. Obviously, there's the hidden agendas behind development, which they really don't want to hear the joined-up voice on, but perhaps within planning and the more money side of the councils, they don't want to hear that. But in other aspects of the council that are affected by it, health and education and other services that are affected by development and by globalisation on a local level, I think they are concerned, and it's about getting people on side within the council as well to fight them.
I just think they're caught up in the system.
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with them. They're the same for you, but
like when we were talking to about building the camp we had underneath the pylon, we went through all the options as to how they could, you know, house people without putting them under the pylon. The position that woman was in, she couldn't have done anything else because of the way she had to fund everything. And, you know, she was in that position because of capitalism, basically.
Mm.
So it's not those people, it's just they're in a position where they should defend a certain interest group. And you have to be aware of it, don't you? And
yeah.
Try and use force of the community rather than your power to take and drive on the meeting.
Yeah, but our significance as force, like you were saying, Roger, you know, it's that if you can be more unified, then your interest can become bigger than their interest in a way, can't it? And it's there are ways to influence, aren't there, in that way?
Sorry, there was a point or a question at the back just now. I don't know if it's still there.
Within the council's queues, I think it's the biggest control in the area of the council. The problem, I think, for me, the biggest difference is it's when money comes in, and it is about development. So if you look at, I mean, obviously there's money in development, and all the sectors are sort of affected. But the council at a kind of grassroots level does some really good stuff, and they get involved with some really good local initiatives, and you know, local newsletters, which around Bristol, some of them are quite good. And they put small amounts of money into small things, and it's really positive. But at the other end, when they talk about we're going to develop a huge area, you know, it does look different because then they're dealing with big business, and people are going to, you know, give them a huge amount of money for a piece of land. And that's different. Then they're knocking because their interest there is shit, we've overspent this year, you know, we need more money, we haven't administered money. Well, of course they're going to go for that. So it is good to distinguish between the
main
parts of the council, but in contrast, that the really bad part of the council is at that top end, dealing with big developments and dealing with big budgets. And that's where, and even at that, I mean, it's run by many suits. Most of the people that are in the council come from the business, and they bring in people who are successful businessmen to run the council. So, of course, they're obsessed with money and property and doing it that way. They don't know any other way. But there's another aspect, is the pressure from the government, and local councils now are pretty dubious that they won't work in housing. In housing, you know, local authority just has to do what the government says. The government sets the targets, and the local council influence them, I guess the same
thing. New build housing.
You know, they don't have a lot of, you know, they can't really say no.
Mm.
And having never worked at the top of them, then I don't know how much, you know, they can resist, but it seems to me that, you know.
Just to say, there's a kind of historical parallel, which I'm quite interested in. But this thing about something you were saying earlier on, that, you know, there's this pressure to raise money, you know, to raise money by selling stuff off, you know, making the council sales off the property, the kind of these targets, which is what you were saying. And, you know, that's definitely true. I mean, just to give you an idea, like, the council made a big play about 5 years ago about how they were going to create these hubs, sporting facilities for children, like these hubs, they call them hubs. And they made it, you know, this is all modern, it's really good stuff, it's, you know, quality, sporting, it's part of a big plan. And they said, you know, we've got, the guy at the council was in charge, so we've got 400 sports pitches in schools and council sites, you know, he's got 400 of those, and we're going to turn these into a series of hub sites. Well, what was actually going on was that they basically decided that they couldn't maintain these, they needed some money, and they couldn't pay for the maintenance, it's the same thing you were talking about. So there's kind of this equation, they could see, well, I've got this land, right, and we have to pay to maintain it. So if we create these hub sites, and obviously that was a buzzword, hub site, you know, that way we can rationalise it all down, right? Sell off some of the land, make some money, stop maintaining all this stuff, save some more money, and keep it to hub sites, and then they'll bust the children from the schools that haven't got playing fields there to these hub sporting facilities. And what they certainly didn't say was that, oh yeah, these hub sports facilities are going to be paid for by selling all the playing fields off. Now, okay, good idea, it might last 30 years, 20, 30 years maybe, but, you know, the historical parallel is like, I don't know, the monarchy, when it used to get into trouble, you know, it caused the English Civil War, in fact, and one of the reasons why the English Civil War happened, because the monarchy got into financial difficulty, the price pressure, because they couldn't pay the soldiers and stuff. So what it did was, you started to sell off crown lands, right, that's what you do. If you're really in trouble, you sell off your crown property, you know. But they got to the point in 1640 where there wasn't, you know, they couldn't actually sell much more stuff off, you know, because people were starting to go, hang on a minute, you know, that's, you know, I might be a duke or something. And I suspect the council will get to that stage in the future, and you kind of might end into the kind of New York going bankrupt situation, where they haven't got the actual assets to sell off anymore, or at least what they're going to sell off will be highly contentious. Now, I would argue that kind of starting to happen. I mean, it's all very well saying below the playing field, get the protest around school, whatever, forget about it. When you start to bang off places like Castle Park, or, you know, places like that, you know, ooh, College Green, you know, or, I don't know, the Dam, I don't know. But, you know, they're going to get to a point where there's going to be a balance between not being able to raise the funding and solving and causing serious trouble to try to set up what they've got left. I don't know if you can comment on that, but that seems to me it's a one-way process. You can't go back.
I think that is true, yeah. And I think some of those things maybe are starting to happen, like you say. You do get to a point where you start selling off things which are contentious. I think, I mean, in a slightly different way, I mean, the new GP surgery polyclinics thing is a similar kind of situation, actually, where you close down all the local GP surgeries and replace them with these big corporate polyclinics owned by Virgin. Tesco's. And friends of mine who are doctors say, I mean, in theory, you know, GPs are able to get together and bid to run these polyclinics. In practice, it's almost impossible. They're going to be run by the supermarkets and Richard Branson and all the rest of it. And it's a similar kind of thing, actually, with, you know, concentrate all the services in one area, everyone has to drive there. There'll probably be an out-of-town shopping centre, a lot of them. But I think it probably is getting to the point where people are starting to wake up now. I think Plainfields is an interesting example because it's so disparate. It's been going on for 20 years. Been losing one playing field a day, apparently, for the last 20 years, I was reading today.
And people do have been starting to rebuy playing fields.
Yeah, and they have. But they've had to spend a lot of money on it. Mm. I mean, this is the other thing. And post offices is another good example. Post offices is a very good example, actually, because people are really up in arms about that. There's more people on the streets about post offices than there were about the Iraq War, easily, if you add it all together over the country. People are furious about it, and it's bringing together people of different ages and different classes in all sorts of communities all over the place. And that's a classic example. You sell those off, you're never going to get sites like that again. And these are sites that can provide all sorts of community services in local communities all around the country, owned by a national body that's not yet privatised. And they're all going to be flogged off. And people are just absolutely bloody furious about that. And the government doesn't get it, because again, it makes sense in a sort of rationalising kind of way. But I think it is getting to the point where people are starting to notice what's happening. But again, you know, if you don't have a narrative of it, if you don't have this sort of narrative of enclosure or the fact that this is just the same old stuff that's been happening for the last 30 years, or globalisation, or whichever way you want to see it, then you just see it as an isolated thing. You just say, bloody government, let's get another government in, they'll sort it out. But they won't, of course. Even though they're all making political capital out of it at the moment, I doubt very much whether they'll be saving the post offices.
Whoever you vote for, the government always.
Well, yes, good point.
And if they're only there for 5 years, they're not going to think long-term planning strategy.
Well,
it's not in their interest to do so.
No, it never is. But I mean, you know, the wider issue is that all political parties have bought into the idea of neoliberalism, and they don't know what else to do. It's very, I mean, it's quite true. You know, it's very easy to sort of get conspiracy-minded about it, but these guys don't know what else to do. They really don't. I was in South Africa for my last book, and the ANC have turned into a bunch of neoliberals, and a lot of the people who used to vote for them, all the black communities in the townships who were getting fucked over, not getting their land back and seeing everything privatised, are really furious about this. I went to interview someone from the ANC government and I said, what's happening here? You've sold off loads of stuff to the World Bank, you've let the IMF write your economic policy, you're not redistributing land because you're scared that the investors are all going to pull out of South Africa. And he was very honest with me. He said, well, what would you do? He said, what's the alternative? He said, it's a unipolar world. Capital's global. If we start doing the things that people want us to do, the economy's going to collapse in 5 minutes, and we're going to have a civil war. So what are you going to do? Because what we're going to do is we're just going to go along with the system, and we're going to do the best we can, because the alternative is to be North Korea. And I thought that was commendably honest, actually. But that's from the ANC. So if the ANC can't do it, who else is going to do it? And this is the thing, that there's no narrative, there's no alternative narrative.
since the end of the Cold War, and this is a big issue, everyone's kind of waiting for one. Everyone's waiting for a sort of alternative here. And they don't know what to do about it.
I think there's a very big alternative narrative in Latin America.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sweeping across the whole continent.
That may be true. It'll be interesting to watch it and see whether the backlash wins, but the backlash has started already against that. It's interesting what's happening in Bolivia at the moment, isn't it, where some of the local communities are declaring autonomy from the government because the government's too left-wing and indigenous, and they're all trying to break the country up.
Most of those are actually being funded by the CIA.
Yeah.
Are they always like that?
They have their finger in Central and South America, increasingly so.
They always have that. But the interesting thing about Latin America is how, you know, what alternative model that will come up with and whether it will last. Latin America has been really interesting for the last 10 or 15 years. Mm. Bolivia, particularly, actually, because Bolivia was the real poster child for globalisation. It was a real the globalisation experiment in Bolivia was astonishing. I mean, they spent 20 years asset stripping the whole country, and it still ended up the poorest country in Latin America, although there was a very small cabal of extremely rich water companies who came from Washington and Britain. But it was astonishing what happened. And the thing about Latin America is that the neoliberal project was tried there far more radically than anywhere else in the world, because there were no protections for anybody. It was a huge experiment, the whole place, and it was a total disaster. Few people made lots of money and everybody else got screwed. So they are trying to formulate an alternative model, but even then they're having problems. I mean, Brazil is having trouble. You know, unless you're Venezuela, because you've got a huge amount of oil that you can make a lot of money from and fund your social reforms, then and then it's very difficult. I mean, in Venezuela, Chavez can do this stuff, because it doesn't matter if the investors pull out of Venezuela. He can nationalise the mines and he can screw people over and he can annoy the capitalists, because he's got a huge fund of oil to sell off and people need it, including the Americans. So he can afford to fund that experiment there, but other countries are finding it more difficult. So
they're absolutely rich in resources, Latin America. They've got gold, they've got copper, they've got everything. Africa has as well, you know.
It's
not really a question of resources, it's people prioritising, people kind of taking power like they have in Venezuela. Mm. I mean, even Cuba, you know, they've had a blockade for 50 years and they've managed to have a lot of the things that we want, you know.
Mm.
And brilliant community and trying to work everything sustainably and good health service, good education, everything. They're all in Latin America, they're going in the complete opposite direction to us. Mm. It's really sad to see. Sometimes they say, well, you've already got that. And I'm saying, well, we did have that, but actually we're losing it.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I think if anyone says there's no alternative, you have to keep pointing them to Latin America and saying, look, because I think that's what we're lacking. We've got plenty of anger, but we're lacking hope.
And we're lacking information, because they're not giving the true story about Bolivia. There's in Bristol, there's a little tiny group called Bristol Bolivia Solidarity Group, and we had a football match on College Green last Saturday, because the only information that the BBC has sort of given on Bolivia was when Maradona and Evo Morales played football, to sort of challenge the world football people who said the altitude's too high and so therefore you can't. But Radio Bristol completely ignored us. So,
not surprised.
But
what's going to be important about Latin America, though, is the fact that Chavez is trying to build these economic blocks. I think that's quite important, the oil. This idea of supplying countries that need to be cheaper oil and this kind of stuff. And, I think the strength of Latin America will be based on whether they can expand those economic blocks, i.e. that the richer resource countries might start to provide resources to the smaller ones. If you can build that, those kind of trading blocks, and there's a potential for that wealth to kind of be redistributed across those countries. But I would also argue without those blocks, they will be finished. By undemocratic or by working capital. So the blocks are important.
Cup two.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.